This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm here with Sambit Roychowdhury from MPA in Gashing. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And this is your first time on the Jodcast, I believe?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. And although you're at Gashing at the moment, you're coming over to Manchester in the not-too-distant future?
Yes, in a couple of months.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that'd be good to have you here. If we just want to start off by talking a little bit about what you do.
Okay, so my interests primarily lie in these small galaxies which are found kind of around the larger galaxies like the Milky Way in which we inhabit. These galaxies are called dwarf galaxies. They are orders of magnitude smaller in mass, fainter in magnitude, but turns out quite important in the larger scheme of things, especially when you think about how the structure in the present day universe has evolved and how it looks the way it looks, why it looks the way it looks. And if you go back in time right after the Big Bang when the first galaxies were formed, what we think today is that the first galaxies that formed are really small, kind of the dwarf galaxies that I'm interested in today. And as time progressed, these small galaxies kind of coalesced or joined together to form the larger galaxies, which dominate the mass in the present-day universe, and those are the galaxies that are so easy to see all around us. So to understand that critical phase in the just after the birth of the universe, when the first structures and the first galaxies were forming, it's important to understand how, when I mean by galaxies were forming, how there was some kind of gravitational potential or dark matter, we don't know much about it, into which the first hydrogen that was all around fell into that dark matter potential, created a disk, so you have a hydrogen disk, and then that hydrogen got converted into stars. So we need to understand how this process happened in the first galaxies, and thereafter we can make a better sense of the rest of the progression of the universe. So my work mainly has been to look at these nearby dwarf galaxies, which we can study in some amount of detail, and the ones which have some amount of fuel or hydrogen left from which stars are formed, to look into those galaxies and try to understand how this fuel is converted into stars. So that's been my main research, and I've been doing other smaller stuff around, but we can talk about it.
Yeah,
if
there's plenty of time for that. So you study these kind of smaller galaxies, and you said these formed first, and that's what the larger galaxies were made of when those kind of came together. Mm. But now you're particularly looking at these nearby small galaxies. Mm. So are the ones that are nearby, are they really, really
similar
to the kind of the first galaxies, or are they actually like different in subtle ways?
That's a very good question. They are actually, we do understand that they should not be similar, because the environment in which they formed, let's put it in that way, was very different when the universe was young. Warmer, much more ways to, you know, ionize the gas, not enough metals around, and other processes which were taking place at the early universe. So the environment was different. The environment today is much, much calmer, let's say. But in some ways, you have to start at some point, right? So these galaxies are nearby. But still, it's only recently that we are slowly attaining the capabilities, which will be enhanced a little more if the square kilometer array comes around, to actually look at the gas in these galaxies in some detail. Still, there are so many unsolved issues because we just cannot absorb them because they are so small. The whole entire amount of signal from various different kinds of phases of the ISM that are coming in. ISM means interstellar medium, anything other than the stars that exist in a galaxy. The signals that come in from various phases of that interstellar medium are still, especially some phases like the molecular phase, the gas which is in molecular form, is still so faint, especially for the really faint ones, even if they're nearby, that they're very difficult to study. Mm-hmm. So we are kind of doing a first step thing, trying to understand what is happening here, and we'll make an educated guess about what can be the slight differences in the early universe and how that might affect things. Mm-hmm. Generally, that educated guess comes in the form of simulations, where people try to simulate the present structure in the universe by starting from the very basics numerically and in different ways. And there, these kind of assumptions and relations and what you understand, they are put in as input to see if you can finally match with what we are seeing. So that's the way the whole game is played. But so therefore, observations are crucial to start this process. So that's basically it.
So they kind of go hand in hand, the observations and simulations, because they offer you different insights.
In some sense, yes. Though I'm not very sure how much it's starting more, but I am not very sure how much crosstalk there is between these two kind of studies.
Yeah.
But for anyone working in this sort of areas where you know that your final aim is to understand the structure around the universe, and by the structure I mean much larger than what our galaxy itself, beyond our galaxy, beyond our local cluster, beyond maybe our supercluster. To understand this whole grand scheme of things that we see around us. So when you are working in either sense, there has to be some amount of crosstalk, though it's not always the case, but I guess that's how it should be.
Yeah. I think there's lots of cases of that in research, though, where there should be more interaction than there is between different groups. So the impression I'm getting is whilst you're studying this kind of some of the smaller objects, that's giving you an insight into the larger scale of the universe. So you mentioned that you're particularly like trying to observe the interstellar medium, so the gas and dust in these small galaxies. And you said it's very difficult to observe the molecular hydrogen you're looking at in these galaxies. So why are you particularly interested in molecular hydrogen rather than ionized hydrogen?
So both from theoretical considerations as well as more and more recent observations of galaxies around us and our own galaxy, molecular clouds, where molecular clouds are like the nurseries where stars are forming. So detailed observations show that it's, as I told you, as you kind of expected, the phase that correlates best with star formation is first of all the really dense gas which collapses to form stars, and that dense gas is kind of cocooned inside the molecular hydrogen, which basically is the fuel of star formation. So the molecular hydrogen collapses gravitationally, and that forms stars. So you kind of expected it, and it's being seen that the molecular hydrogen is related to star formation. The tough thing about molecular hydrogen is because of the structure of the molecule, it's very hard to observe. It doesn't have any strong detectable emission lines, which is our favorite way of observing stuff, right?
So the wavelength that it emits at isn't very specific to molecular hydrogen.
That would have been fine. It is very faint. The transition is because of it's a very symmetric molecule, and you don't really have a transition which is strong enough to be observed. There is, but it's very faint.
It gets drowned out by everything else around it.
Yes, that's always the issue, right? You have to detect it. So the favorite way of people to locate where molecular hydrogen will be was to look for the next two most abundant elements, which are carbon and oxygen. Okay, let me keep aside helium for the moment. Just carbon, the next two ones, carbon and oxygen, and they form this molecule, the carbon monoxide molecule, which is generally found in these molecular cloud complexes. There is a way to relate the amount of emission you are observing from this carbon monoxide molecule with the amount of hydrogen there is. Now, the issue comes in I briefly probably mentioned, in these kind of small galaxies, metals are less. Metals are generally formed through star formation. So in the first galaxies, there would have been almost no metals. Then the first stars came, they blew up in supernovae. The metals were ejected into the galaxy, then out of the galaxy maybe, into the medium around the galaxy called the circumgalactic medium. Then as later generations of galaxies formed and coalesced together, these materials from the circumgalactic medium was again absorbed into the galaxy, and they stayed there. These metals, mainly in the form of dust grains, are very crucial in forming this molecular hydrogen from which the stars will form itself. There are a couple of ways in which they are crucial for this molecular hydrogen to form. Now, the thing is, if the metals are less, what happens is throughout the galaxy, there's a very strong field of ultraviolet radiation. That is created by older stars that have formed, even sometimes background quasars and stuff. But let's say the older stars that have formed. So this ultraviolet field that runs through the galaxy, the hydrogen needs to be shielded against it so that it can convert from the atomic to the molecular phase. Atomic hydrogen is the most abundant element. It's everywhere. But it's warm, generally. It is in various kind of phases. Much of it is warm. Some of it is cold. You have to turn it from the warm to the cold first, and cold atomic hydrogen will go to the molecular hydrogen phase. And to do that, you need metals or dust to shield it. Now, if the metallicity is lower, maybe the hydrogen is forming. This carbon monoxide is even more critically dependent whether it forms on this metallicity because of the same shielding effect. Mm-hmm. The carbon and oxygen atoms should exist as atoms. Then they should join together to form the molecule. For all of this to happen, the background field should be shielded against. Mm-hmm. So what happens is in these kind of low metallicity environments, the hydrogen was supposed to be traced by carbon monoxide. But maybe for similar amount of hydrogen that is present, the amount of carbon monoxide that is present falls very quickly. So now this not only do you have intrinsically less amount of hydrogen because these are small galaxies, yep. right? Even if the ratio of molecular hydrogen to carbon monoxide was same, you would have had a smaller signal. Now it is compounded by the fact that with the metallicity and hence the dust going down, that amount of carbon monoxide is falling exponentially, let's say.
Because you don't have the shielding, which means that it can't cool and it can't form, I see.
So it's very difficult to not only necessarily in these galaxies, even the say very outskirts and low metallicity regions of spiral galaxies, large spiral galaxies, it's very difficult to observe carbon monoxide and therefore to interpret how much hydrogen there is. Therefore, this is the basic problem. People are trying to get around the issue by many ways. Also, I am sure people may have heard about the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, the ALMA, which has come over. So ALMA is a much more sensitive instrument, which has already been started to be used by various people to look at the carbon monoxide emission in these kind of smaller galaxies. So things will change, but it's still difficult to do for these kind, particularly this kind of galaxies.
So, something I just wanted to clarify is, I know when astronomers talk about metals, they often mean something quite different to what most people think of as metals.
Right, I should have explained that. Yes.
Oh, no, that's...
So anything other than hydrogen and helium are metals.
Yeah, it's one of those things astronomers, kind of everything except for hydrogen and helium is a metal.
Yes.
But it's good to clarify
yes,
that
yes,
one.
Of course. It's not like the iron and nickel. And of course, they are also there.
They're included. Yeah.
Yes, but they're in so minuscule proportions compared to the... I think mostly metallicities are measured by measuring the emission from... generally much was less atomic number elements like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, stuff like that.
So the lighter elements, just because there's much more of them, I suppose.
Yes, means you can at least detect it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the other stuff is very hard to detect, except from stars maybe.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you're kind of hoping that ALMA will lead for some developments in this area. Like, do you think it's the kind of thing where you'll see kind of big breakthroughs with ALMA, or are you really waiting for the SKA before you can get anywhere?
So they will look at very different things. As I mentioned, ALMA is probably for looking at the molecular gas in some sense, and through using other submillimeter instruments and arrays, people have already started pushing the limits for observing the molecular hydrogen in these kind of low metallicity, small star-forming galaxies which exist around the big galaxies. ALMA will push it. It depends. It's not very clear how. Only time will tell.
Yep.
Because ALMA can observe at very high resolutions. Mm-hmm. So it is, for the moment, I guess, we are picking out the same molecular clouds, the central or the very dense portions of these clouds. The atomic hydrogen from which this molecular hydrogen is supposed to form, the present day interferometers that are used observe at a much coarser resolution. So in that sense, when SKA comes along, it will be sensitive, better resolution in always it will be in all these terms, it will be better. But as you can understand, they're probing kind of two different phases,
very different regimes,
And phases of the ISM. But there are ways to probe maybe the molecular hydrogen content through other lines too, not necessarily the carbon monoxide line. Or you can go take a circuitous route using dust. So all these kind of possibilities exist. So any ALMA breakthrough in this area will not create maybe as much of a buzz as it is creating regarding, say, planetary disks or various other stuff. Because it's not very much in the consciousness of people. It's not a very... How should I put it? It's not a very, very...
Fashionable
area, yes. So, but whatever we understand of the process might have much deeper and much longer lasting effect on the way we understand structure formation. Because Well, maybe this is time to mention the two things that anyone who works on dwarf galaxies does mention. There are some very interesting things that affect especially the dwarf galaxy end. What do you mean by affect? Mismatches between what is observed and what is predicted from these kind of simulations. And there are a couple of big mismatches, both affecting this dwarf galaxy end. And what are the mismatches? One of them is, for some time now, the simulations which mainly trace the major amount of mass that is in the universe, which is dark matter, and how this dark matter evolves with time and how the structures are formed, and then post facto put in gas and then star formation on these dark matter structures. Yes, because it's computationally you have to set limits. Those are limits are being pushed. When it was done in this way, what was found was the amount of dwarf galaxies that you should have seen as you go down in mass. So it's basically a function of how many galaxies in a particular range of mass should exist. So you go down, it should continually increase according to dark matter.
So you have more and more smaller things.
And not only more and more, a huge number of them. Observationally, it was nowhere as close. There were orders of magnitude difference, not even going to very low masses.
So is this the missing satellites problem?
This is basically the missing satellites problem. Okay, so this is one of the things. People have been, some very clever people have been trying to find out ways to understand why it's happening this way. And there are promising leads to understand what might be happening, why the reality is different from what you might naively interpret just by looking at, say, dark matter potentials. And if you understand the physics a little bit more, and that's why this physics comes in.
So you really have to understand how the gas is converting
into stars and how, and this is crucial, how the stars in turn affect the gas. Because stars put in energy into the gas. They disturb the gas around it. They sometimes blow out the gas. And this happens a lot in the small galaxies. And the second mismatch that was happening between what was predicted from these kind of dark matter simulations and observations was how the mass profile, how much mass there is with the increasing radius, varies between how what is observed, or at least interpreted from observations, and what is expected from this dark matter simulations. How the dark matter mass profile should be and how we observe it to be. So this was basically the core cusp problem. Okay. Even here, sometimes very similar kind of effects, like the same thing I told you, how stars affect the gas and in turn the dark matter gravitationally, are promising to be the major solution towards these kind of problems. So these small galaxies, which were kind of in the backwaters of astronomy for a long time, are turning out to be very crucial players. And even though what they kind of do not have in impact in terms of mass or brightness, they're kind of making up in terms of how they actually control stuff before. And so this is one of the issues. Maybe this is a time where I should quickly relate to one of your previous questions about the dwarfs that formed right after the beginning of the universe and the present comes in. That might be one of the reasons why this discrepancy in number counts, the missing satellites problems, that has been suggested as one of the reasons that in the early universe, there was a certain cutoff, which was applied due to physical reasons on the mass of the dark matter halo, which could form dwarf galaxies. So there are a lot of dark matter halos which just kept hanging around there without finally forming galaxies. So that is one of the ways to solve the problem.
Clumps of dark matter, but without any gas and stars in them. So we wouldn't see them because they wouldn't be bright.
That's the thing. So I am not an expert in this field, so I don't know how people might have thought about observing them. So there are cases, I think, where there have been claims of finding a dark galaxy which has gas, but no stars. Okay.
Oh, wow. That's still an interesting point in itself.
Or really faint galaxies which have a lot of gas in them, but very little amount of star formation. So all these kind of things exist. In many ways, we are at the very beginning of our understanding. So new observations come in every day. Various kind of claims are happening. A lot of galaxies are sometimes being found in a survey, very faint ones. There have been recent papers which have come out about finding lots of small galaxies. But so at some point, we will sit down and, you know, put everything together, but it's very much an active field, trying and we're trying to understand what is going on.
But that makes it an exciting place to be, right?
Yes, of course, yeah.
And I think as well, like, so you've kind of got two points on it. And from the observational point of view, you're just getting to the point now where you can start making some good observations and getting more numbers. But then on the simulation point of view as well, they've probably in the past struggled with resolution. And as you were saying, they've massively relied on just looking at dark matter and not thinking about all of the astrophysics. And maybe in the next few years, we'll be at a point where they can actually get some of the astrophysics in as well.
No, the astrophysics is already there, but it was limited by the limitations of the observations themselves.
Oh, right, okay.
Right, because...
So we just don't have enough information yet.
Yes, so and it's as it will get better, the observations will get better, the recipes, the equations that are put in will become more and more refined.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so it's a back and forth process. Mm-hmm. I think dark matter simulations have been a huge success story overall.
Mm-hmm.
Just that using a supercomputer, you can almost create an entire universe. It's quite fascinating. And so it's just a matter of probably fine-tuning and trying to understand. And the thing is, if everything was explained, then where will be the fun? How will you
That's
learn?
That's true. We'd be out of a job.
So the science comes out from the mismatches.
Yeah.
So once you see that, okay, there is a difference between what you're observing and what you're seeing, you try to understand what is the physical process which caused this mismatch. So that's where the science comes from. And you'll continuously do it. And hopefully that will keep many people interested in science, astrophysics, and the bigger questions, and it'll continue.
So it's a really good point. Thank you for coming on the Jodcast.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure. And thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, hopefully we'll have you on again in the future.